Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's not your average job opening, that's for sure. What to say about the Pope as CEO? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 11th of February. Good as always to have you with us. CEOs come and go. We know that. Companies have change and turnover at the top with some degree of regularity. But the news from the Vatican today was kind of amazing, that Pope Benedict is going to abdicate at the end of the month. Hasn't happened in 600 years. So amid all the stories out there about what happens now and who's in the running for the Vatican corner office, a look back at Benedict XVI, not as shepherd, but as CEO. Marketplace's Mark Garrison gets us going.
Succession planning, that's the corporate world term Thomas Harvey of Notre Dame's business school uses for what the Pope did today. Harvey is a former CEO of Catholic Charities USA.
To have said to the church, we need people who can do this faster, better, and be more nimble than I can at 85. I think that's a profound statement of a manager.
Other management moves fell short.
There were issues of banking, lack of oversight.
He made cleaning up shady Vatican finances a priority. It's an unfinished task. Critics also say his leadership was weak on confronting sexual abuse scandals. Boston College theology professor Thomas Groom teaches church management MBA students. He says Pope Benedict's legacy is intellectual, not managerial.
He will be rated as a better teacher than he was a manager.
One with more competition, grappling with the growth of Pentecostalism in developing countries. Groom says Pope Benedict didn't inspire donations the way his predecessor did.
I'm not sure that this man has been able to raise the monies that perhaps John Paul II had attracted.
But popes aren't ultimately measured by revenue. They're supposed to be spiritual leaders, not technocrats. Longtime Vatican reporter Delia Gallagher has a reality check for anyone with visions of sweeping change.
Remember, Pope doesn't come in like a CEO and change up the whole management. On the whole, the people that work in the Vatican work for life.
All the management skill in the world is no match for the history of a 2,000-year-old faith of a billion people. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Here in Southern California, the search for former Los Angeles police officer Christopher Dorner continues. He is suspected of killing three people, including a police officer, and wounding two others. There is now a reward of a cool $1 million for information leading to his capture. It's one of the biggest local rewards ever offered. But as Marketplace's Chrissy Clark reports, even big payouts like that don't necessarily get big results.
If you're interested in the $1 million reward, you call a number that leads you here.
Chris Dorner, Task Force.
The reward money comes from a strange combination of places: the L.A. Dodgers, the FBI, six anonymous donors, and lots of local governments. L.A. County is considering adding another $100K. Tony Bell is a spokesman. He says putting public money toward a reward,
it's an investment in public safety, and it costs savings from having to have a killer on the loose. More lives lost, more resources expended.
Big rewards can also bring big publicity, reaching people who might have valuable info. Gene Ferrara is a retired policeman on the board of Crime Stoppers in Cincinnati. They're a nonprofit that offers cash rewards raised by donations to useful tipsters.
It's, how do I say this, free money. They're not out working hard and digging a ditch for 8 hours. They just provide information and they get money for it.
He says that money leads to hundreds of arrests each year. Still, millions in reward money goes unclaimed around the country. People fear risking their own safety if they get involved. And Ferrara says the bigger the reward, the harder it is to remain anonymous.
The IRS is going to want their cut. That's income, so you can't be anonymous.
There's another risk with a high price tag. Adam Alter is a professor of marketing and psychology at New York University. He says if your friend or family and on the fence about turning in someone you love, a big reward might actually backfire.
You're turning it into an economic transaction for someone's freedom, which I think is to a lot of people quite offensive.
Alter says sometimes it's better to keep money out of it and let doing the right thing be its own reward. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, choppy, bumpy, unsettled. All of the above. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. 2 years ago today, after a month of sometimes violent protests, Hosni Mubarak was forced to resign as the president of Egypt. There is now a new president, but not much more political stability. And depending on the day, just as much unrest on the streets protesting the new regime. It is not, one could easily imagine, a business-friendly environment. Hisham Fahmy is the CEO of the American Chamber of Commerce in Egypt. Mr. Fahmy, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
If an American businessman, Mr. Fahmy, wanted to come to Cairo today and have a couple of meetings and see some people, would that be a wise thing?
Sure. You know, he or she have to avoid a particular part of town, but we do have many visitors at the moment, and there are a couple of hotels right in the middle of the action, but otherwise there are very safe hotels.
I have to say, you sound almost blasé. You sound almost...
well, you can't... I mean, we've lived there, through it for a while, so we're getting used to where to go and where not to go.
Well, it has been a while. It's been 2 years. I wonder how, first of all, the Egyptian economy deals, but then the international investment community. What do they think when they look at Cairo and contemplate going there and spending their money?
It has been 2 years since the revolution, but it all hasn't been tragic. There are times that are much worse than now. There are times that are much better than now. On the economy, of course, the Egyptian economy is suffering badly, especially tourism, which is 11% of GDP. All our friends from around the world who are actually really waiting to support Egypt and the Egyptian economy are on hold, and that is precarious.
But when people call you, American multinationals call you, and they say, Hisham, listen, we need to come for a meeting, and I'm reluctant to do so. How do you convince them when they're seeing on television things that are not friendly to business, one would imagine?
You know, we're always looking at the long-term picture for Egypt. The potential of Egypt is there. And, you know, there are times when, yes, don't come this week, you know, come next week. And there are people who are reaping some opportunities. I mean, this is a French company, but Danone has been growing double-digit figures in the last 2 years. General Motors has been growing. Unfortunately, it has affected the smaller companies, people who can't afford to... keep paying their employees, and you know, there are pros and cons.
Are you disappointed? Did you expect it would be different today, 2 years on?
I had expected it to be better in a shorter time. I think everybody was hoping. Yes, of course, we're disappointed, and we hope the political scene and the security issues are settled very quickly. There is always hope.
Hisham Fahmy, he is the CEO of the American Chamber of Commerce. We got him in Cairo. Thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you.
After the State of the Union tomorrow night, President Obama is going to hit the road, as presidents do after States of the Union. He's going to wind up in Chicago on Friday for another speech, this one about gun violence, and he's picked his turf pretty well. There were more than 500 homicides in Chicago last year, the vast majority of them gun-related. And besides the people, that kind of violence does damage to neighborhoods and families and the economy. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Marketplace's Sylvester Monroe reports now from Englewood on Chicago's South Side.
At one time, 63rd Street, going across here, this was a really vibrant economic community. Now, the number of vacant lots you see is just like that. That's a corner lot. There's nothing on it. Look at that. On a major thoroughfare. This could be any street in Englewood. The neighborhood has one of the highest homicide rates in the city. Not to mention one of the highest unemployment rates. 40% of the people who live here are unemployed. For those who do work in Englewood, dealing with violence is part of the job.
Yeah, I was here. I heard the shot, but I didn't see what happened because I was in there working.
A barber tells me he heard shots the day before in front of his shop. A 20-year-old man was shot in the face 3 times.
And that's where they put the police line up across the... because I see the tape on that side of the street and that side of the street.
Yeah, they had it all taped off.
The barber didn't want to give his name for fear of gang retaliation. He told me how he's had to change the way he does business.
If I don't know you, that's it.
Really?
Yeah. Especially at certain hours. I just don't take them. It's not worth the risk.
He won't take walk-ins because it's just not safe. The cost of doing business in Inglewood, where yellow police tape is now as common as bulletproof glass in corner stores.
So one thing that happens when violence is driving people and businesses out of the city is that it obviously reduces the tax base, which degrades the ability of the city government to address the violence problem, which generates more violence, which drives out more of the tax base and so on. So that's a very unfortunate cycle.
Jens Ludwig is director of the University of Chicago Crime Lab. He says that every homicide in Chicago reduces the city's population by 70 people. People who either leave or choose not to move to Chicago because of the violence. People who may have occupied a now boarded-up home, owned a business, paid taxes that kept cops on the streets and kids in schools.
What you wind up with in some of these very disadvantaged neighborhoods is even higher concentrations of poverty, and all of that further fuels the risk of violence in the neighborhoods.
Ludwig estimates that the total social cost of violence in Chicago is $2.5 billion each year. And the common thread among cities with soaring murder rates is segregation, both racial and economic. Inglewood is almost entirely black, and now almost entirely poor.
Finally, to meet you. Pleasure.
Cyron Smith is an exception. He owns a home with his wife near Inglewood and works as an office manager. But he grew up in housing projects, mostly black, mostly poor, and definitely violent.
Now, I was born in 75, so I remember at 6 years old, which was 81, asking my mom, why was blacks killing each other?
A question he's still asking himself, and a major reason he spends nights and weekends mentoring teens on the South Side, trying to make them feel good about themselves.
The black community had to feel good again. When you don't feel good, you're not trying to do nothing. You're not motivated. With the beat down happening all the time in these neighborhoods, I tell them you're in the oven and the temperature's up high. When do you have time to feel good?
He teaches them that education is the only way to break the cycle of violence in the community, and that education also leads to economic prosperity.
So let's go around with our introductions.
My name is Malik Phipps.
15-year-old Malik Phipps and 13-year-old Khalil Stringer are two of the teens that Smith mentors. They say getting an education in Inglewood is a bit complicated sometimes.
I'm concerned that just walking home from school, it might be a shooting somewhere in my area, and I'll probably get shot. I'm very concerned about that.
And they see how living with violence can change people.
People just don't feel safe going anywhere. They have to watch their back. They feel like they have to carry a weapon on them. They don't trust anybody that walks past them. And people don't seem like too nice these days.
It's hard for the boys to concentrate on the future when the present is so perilous. But Khalil's got an idea he thinks could solve a few of Inglewood's problems.
Like all these abandoned fields, they should make more libraries so that I could actually go somewhere in my neighborhood to go concentrate.
A small idea to help solve a giant problem. But maybe his generation is a good place to start. In Chicago, I'm Sylvester Monroe for Marketplace.
Tomorrow on the broadcast, what housing policy in Chicago might have to do with the violence there. In the meanwhile, you can get a sense of what the Inglewood neighborhood looks like in the slideshow at our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, you know what they say, lies, damned lies, and...
You can tell a story that is de facto true, but also grossly misleading at the same time.
Statistics. But first, let's do the numbers. Light and quiet on Wall Street to start the week. The Dow Industrials fell 21 points, about a 10% for the blue chips, closed at 13,971. The NASDAQ gave back a point, less than a 10%, finished at 3,192. The S&P 500 was flat, ended things at 1517. Energy stocks took a pause from their recent bull run. ExxonMobil leaked 1/3 of 1%. Natural gas and oil producer Southwestern Energy slipped 2 2/3% today. Google investors were not thrilled to hear that Executive Chairman Eric Schmidt is planning to sell $2.5 billion worth of his Google stock. So they searched for a different place to put their money. The search engine's shares fell 0.3% today. Bank stocks mostly outperformed the market. Citigroup added more than 1%. Bank of America gained 0.8% today. But Morgan Stanley shed 0.2%. In Tokyo, stock markets was closed, as were many across Asia, because of Chinese New Year. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.96%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up tomorrow. In Washington, a look at the nation's balance sheet. The Treasury Department is scheduled to release its monthly statement for January. A Senate Judiciary Subcommittee discusses proposals to reduce gun violence. And it's Fat Tuesday, Shrove Tuesday, or Pancake Tuesday. The day to live it up before the beginning of Lent. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Imagine for a moment your business is doing well, really, really well, booming here, practically exploding overseas. Now imagine you can't meet that demand because what it is that you make has to sit for years before you can sell it. And so we arrive at the sad, sad place where Maker's Mark bourbon is going to be watered down to create enough supply. Marketplace's David Weinberg has that story.
For whiskey to be labeled bourbon, it has to be made from at least 51% corn, distilled at no higher than 160 proof, be aged in a white oak barrel, and it doesn't have to be made in Kentucky, but it does have to be made in America.
If you meet those requirements, you are bourbon.
Michael Veach is the author of Kentucky Bourbon Whiskey and American Heritage. He says Maker's Mark is one of the few family-operated distilleries remaining in the United States. The distillery started making bourbon in 1954, right around the time Amos Milburn recorded the song Let Me Go Home Whiskey.
Let me go home whiskey.
In recent years, bourbon has been on a roll. Sales have tripled outside the U.S.
The problem is that these last 10 years, the industry has been growing faster than anybody thought it ever would.
That is a problem for aged whiskey like Maker's. The bourbon distilling now won't be out of the casks for another 6 years. Beam Incorporated, which owns Maker's, says it hasn't made enough to keep up with demand. So Rob Samuels, the grandson of Maker's founder, announced a solution. Maker's will lower the alcohol content by 6.6% by adding water to each batch. That could turn some loyal fans off the brand, which is why it made the announcement in an email to customers it calls ambassadors, like Eric Motter in Kansas City. As an ambassador, he subscribes to an email list, and he receives gifts each year, like a knitted sweater for his bottle.
Maybe they should cut out the free gift for the ambassadors and keep the bourbon at full strength.
And be warned, if you're a bourbon drinker, the supply problem is industry-wide. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
It's bad news, man. Very, very bad news. All right, it's entirely possible that iPods and iPads and iPhones aren't going to be enough for Apple. Both the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times report today that the company is working on something like a watch, a smart watch, I guess. Apple itself is doing what it usually does, that is, saying nothing. But Marketplace's Jim Burris reports a lot of people think technology like that is coming to a wrist near you sooner rather than later.
The idea of a timepiece that does more than tell time isn't exactly new. When I was in school, all the cool kids had a Casio calculator watch. And a decade ago, Microsoft unveiled a watch that gave sports scores and weather called Smart Personal Object Technology. But the SPOT was an FLOP. So why would Apple's version fare better? Sarah Rotman Epps is an analyst at Forrester Research.
Apple has a pattern of taking a look at what technology is out there but not working very well and improving it to the point that consumers crave it.
Ed Price is director of research partnerships at Georgia Tech. He says a smartwatch doesn't have to replicate all the functionality of an iPad or iPhone.
Or a phone call comes in, your phone is silenced, but the caller ID information is on your watch display. So it actually makes your existing smartphone or your iPad work better than it does right now.
The question is how to make it. Price says the technology for a small, bendable display exists. Corning makes the glass used in the iPhone and says it's developed a type of bendable glass. However it's made, Piper Jaffray's Gene Munster says expect to see the watch sooner rather than later.
In Apple's case, we think that they are always looking to find something better than their existing business, and this would fit that category.
Munster says smartwatches and smart glasses are the two arenas where consumers are most likely to see new mobile computing technologies. Now, what to call it? iWatch, iTime, iWrist? In Atlanta, I am Jim Burris for Marketplace.
Remember this number, because you're going to need it later on in the interview you're about to hear. 2.998. In other words, not quite 3.0. Might sound like some random statistic, but I assure you it's not. And it is evidence that there is more to statistics, so much more than just numbers. Charles Whelan's new book is called Naked Statistics. Welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
I'm going to go to the subtitle here, which is Stripping the Dread from the Data. And I would just submit that a book on statistics does nothing at all to strip the dread from the data for me.
Oh, statistics is sexy, according to Hal Varian, chief economist of Google. Now, I think that's
Google
a little oversold.
It must be true.
It's a little oversold. In fact, statistics are everywhere, from Netflix determining what kind of movies you want to watch, to retailers coming up with sophisticated, bordering on scary methods for figuring out what your shopping habits are going to be. So statistics are these essential tools that process data and, by definition, simplify it, which is, of course, also where we can get in a spot of trouble.
Well, explain that last bit, because that seems to me to be the crux of the whole thing, right?
Well, if you think about a courtroom, both the prosecutor and the defense attorney have access to the same basic information. They are both going to look at that information, and they are going to simplify it and present it in vastly different ways. Those of us who think that we're intellectually honest will try and present a balanced picture. But there are a lot of folks out there who have no interest in presenting a balanced picture. And as soon as you start simplifying, using some very objective figures, you can tell a story that is de facto true, but also grossly misleading at the same time.
Is this where we get into trouble with statistics and policy analysis?
This is where we get in trouble with statistics and everything. I mean, statistics are like online dating, right? You can say things in your things in your profile that are true, but by acts of omission or different emphasis, you might leave out or stress some things that present a picture of you that is not wholly accurate.
I wonder also if there's not a certain incompleteness or lack of context that a number gives. I mean, you know, I set up in the introduction of the story, my GPA out of college was 2.998. And I'm certainly no rocket scientist, but you know, I did more good than just a 2.998 GPA in college.
Well, first of all, the statistician in me says that your grade point average was 3.0. You're clearly going to round
bless
up.
Bless you. I knew we had you
descriptive
on the show for a
statistics. Descriptive statistics is an important part of statistics, right? And here we are.
Yeah.
And certainly your online dating profile will say 3.0. One thing we have to wrestle with is that even with this proliferation of data, sometimes the answers are more elusive than we would like to think. And in some cases, data and statistics can add a precision that actually becomes quite dangerous. So let's think about the global financial crisis.
Yeah.
We thought that we had risk under control. So if you go back and think about the value at risk models that a lot of the investment banks were
using.
They were gathering all kinds of data and manipulating them. A lot of people were getting paid a lot of money to manipulate them into a simplified measure of the firm's overall risk. Well, those data only went back a certain period of time, and therefore they did not capture the possibility that real estate prices might correct, which they did. The result was a false precision, and this is something I emphasize in the book, that because we thought we had this precise measure of risk, we turned off common sense, we stopped paying attention to other indicators, and the precision of that value at risk indicator masked the true risk of what was going on.
Help me then be an informed consumer.
Well, the first thing you want to remember is if you see a statistic, you see a research finding, until it's corroborated in other ways, it's just one finding.
So the answer really is proceed with caution. Be, you know, it's lies, damn lies, and statistics. It's be skeptical.
I think proceed with caution is exactly right. But don't let it be too cautious, because we have entered this world where we have lots of data. The statistical tools for analyzing it are very powerful. And if you're in retailing, you're law enforcement, you're in the social sciences, there are valuable relationships to be gleaned here.
Charles Whelan teaches public policy up at Dartmouth. His book is called Naked Statistics, Stripping the Dread from the Data. Although somehow I have to tell you, I still don't buy the stripping the dread thing. But, you know.
A little of the dread. Some of the dread.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Good to be with you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A couple of final thoughts about the Pope before we go. Benedict XVI is going to leave behind a few perks he had on the job. For one, his new Pope Mobile, a Mercedes-Benz modified M-Class crossover in what's called papal white. The base model goes for anywhere from about $50,000 to over $100,000, but the Pope Mobile itself is believed to have been donated to the Vatican. Pope Benedict, by the way, does not know how to drive, never got a driver's license, but he does have a helicopter pilot's license and even likes to fly the papal helicopter. Who knew they had one of those, right? And with that, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM on this Monday. Today, the Dow off 21 points, about a 10th percent. The NASDAQ gave back a point, less than a 10th percent. The S&P 500 was pretty much flat. Our producers include Bridget Bodner, Mary Dew, Nancy Fargali, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Megan Larson, Jolie Padokas, and Chow Tu. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you back here tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.